Hey everyone, it's Lindsay here with a quick message before we start. We recorded this episode before we found out about the release date and everything else that's happened today with the announcement of the special edition of Cuckoo's Calling coming out. So you're not going to hear us talk about any of that in today's episode. You will hear us each make predictions about what day we think the book is going to be released and pay attention to who had the closest guess there. Spoiler alert, Sam and I were tied. But we hope you enjoy today's episode anyway, and we will definitely be talking and freaking out about the release date, which is September 26th, in our next episode.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Pulse.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of The Ink Black Heart, this time covering chapters 45 through 47 of Part 3. And today we have somebody who a lot of you have been requesting to be back on the show. We love having him on. It's Sam.
Hello.
Hi, Sam.
Hi, Sam.
Hey.
I've been telling you your fans want you back.
You're so popular. This will please that one listener who said we needed to have a man on sometimes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is your first time for the Ink Black Heart, right?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. I think this is correct that today, this is the 60th episode that we're recording.
Oh my God.
Oh.
So you're on for that. Great way to celebrate.
Rocking. Awesome.
Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of the Ink Black Heart will occasionally reference the ending of this book, as well as the rest of the books in series. But of course, before we get started on chapters for this episode, we do have a few things to go over, and a lot of them are really exciting.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Super exciting.
So first, a couple weeks ago on April 4th, it was the 10-year anniversary of The Cuckoo's Calling being released. Can you believe that?
Oh my goodness. God. It feels like a lifetime ago and like yesterday at the same time.
Yeah.
I feel like I've accomplished fuck all in those 10 years. That's a bit upsetting because I'm like looking at where I was reading The Cuckoo's Calling for the first time and I'm looking at and I'm like,
I feel like I kind of have an opposite, I guess.
Yeah, you've had like two kids.
Well, I mean, I remember finding out that she wrote it and ordering the book right away. But I think at that point I had just gotten engaged. So I feel like,
oh my God,
you know, with Harry Potter, how people kind of say it went with them through their childhood. For me, this one feels like it's kind of gone with me through adulthood, sort of, and becoming a mother and like, you know.
Aww.
That's really
sweet.
That's sweet.
A little sentimental.
For me, it was
there.
Just my companion while I was languishing in grad school.
I mean, I think Troubled Blood was there for all of us during the pandemic, too.
That's true.
Oh, yeah.
Well, happy 10 years.
Happy 10 years. Yeah.
Yeah,
I don't think I could have predicted this, you know, how much I would love them and everything. But here we are. And J.K. Rowling tweeted about it. She said, The Cuckoo's Calling, the first Strike book, was published 10 years ago today. Thank you to at Little Brown UK for taking on the unknown Robert Galbraith and every reader who's helped make the books bestsellers. The 7th, Aww. The Running Grave, will be out later this year.
Yay! I'm so excited.
What we need to know is when. When?
When? She responded to a few people who directly asked for the date, but she didn't give one. So that tells me that I think they probably have an agreed upon announcement day. I guess it's possible it hasn't been decided yet, but I'm thinking that it just hasn't come yet.
I feel like she's probably deep in editing right now because she hasn't tweeted in a while, right?
Yeah.
She did say she was editing. Yeah. It's
been a couple of weeks, I think, now since the last time that she tweeted. So she's probably knee deep.
It's been 11 days. Not that I'm counting.
Right.
It's been 11 days since she tweeted about Strike.
Oh
no, I'm just looking at the calendar. It's April 15th today. She tweeted April 4th. I can do math. That's all.
Wow. But I mean, later this year means that we were right. We said this year.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so go us. That's already one hit as far as I'm concerned on the prediction list.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it was just us. A lot of people were, you know.
There were some people that were like, oh, that's too soon. You know, they're going to need all this time to edit. And, you know, there's no way it'll be out before the end of the year.
Well, that doesn't follow with the timeline that they normally have, right?
Yeah. Those people might not have been working with the same data that we were working with. Shout out to Katie because her little graph of everything that's happened.
Oh my gosh, it's amazing.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Should we each get more specific and pick an actual date that we predict it's going to be out?
Sure.
Okay.
Let's do it. If one of us gets it right, what do we?
That would
I feel
be
like
amazing.
We win a prize.
We tweet about it, I guess, with a link to the clip. So I'm going to predict that it's out September 6th.
Is that a Tuesday?
I don't know, but it's my birthday and I want a birthday present book. So,
well, I mean, if you want to win though.
Do they really only come out on Tuesdays?
Yeah.
All right. I will guess September 5th.
Okay. September 5th.
Yeah. September 5th. Official guess. Yeah.
I'm going to do exactly what you're doing because this is my answer as well. I'm picking September 12th because that's the day after my birthday.
Oh, there we go.
I want another birthday book. Trouble Blood was the same way. It came out the Tuesday after my birthday. So
mm-hmm. Best you know. Birthday present ever.
Absolutely.
It was the best birthday present ever.
I'm going to throw out a guess of November 17th.
Okay.
Is that your birthday?
It's not. My birthday is actually February 5th. So unfortunately, no luck for me as far as a birthday book.
November 17th, eh?
Yeah.
That's close to Strike's birthday. Oh,
yeah. Either the 14th or the 17th. That's a Tuesday or a Friday.
Now you're picking 2 days. I see.
Yeah. Because it's kind of close to the holiday season, just a short enough amount of time that if people, you know, don't want to buy it right away, they could buy it for somebody for Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's logical.
But yeah, I'm going to guess towards the end of the year. I'm guessing she wouldn't have it in December. I'm not really familiar enough with how publishing houses' schedules work, but I'm going to say sometime in November.
What about you, Sam?
I went in the middle of all of you guys. I was thinking October. Okay. I'm looking at the calendar. I'm going to go October the 10th because it's exactly a month after my birthday. Yeah. Okay. So that's what I'm guessing.
Wow. Okay. I could feel October 10th. I could feel it. Whichever date this book comes out, I think we're all just really glad it's coming out.
Mm-hmm. I'm so excited.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She said a lot of other things on Twitter about it.
To start out, she mentioned that Pat has several key moments in this book. Which is obviously exciting.
That's exciting.
Yes.
Not only that, though, she said that we will not be disappointed by Pat in the running grave.
I'm never disappointed by Pat, ever.
I know, but that tells me tells me it's really good, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know when I joked about Strike confessing his feelings to Pat? I'm starting to think that's not as crazy as I thought.
That would be amazing.
Oh, giving his feelings about Robin.
Yes. Okay. What do you think? Yes, Pat, I love you.
That Strike fell in love with Pat? I don't know.
He looked at her. She looked at him. Could it be? It was. They were both drunk.
They both inhaled their e-cigarettes simultaneously.
Suddenly, the resemblance to her ex-husband wasn't so bad.
Oh, my God. Oh, perfect.
Okay.
Oh, my God. You know what? I cannot wait for a predictions episode because I'm going to come up with so many Pat moments that we might see. Pat fights off the murderer at the end of the book.
Yeah.
Predicted.
Yeah. Somehow her e-cigarette is used as a weapon against the killer.
She blows the cotton
day.
Candy flavored smoke in the killer's face. The killer, you know, coughs himself to death. I don't know.
I'm excited though about Pat. It's going to be so good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pat has never disappointed since we've met her.
Never, not a single second.
But this is exciting because it tells there's some good moments there.
So what else did she say on Twitter, Kenz?
Joe mentioned that Strike sits at a pew at the St. John the Baptist Church in Almerton, three rows from the back, and it's on the right-hand side, I believe she said. Now, there's no word on why, but I was thinking, I don't know, maybe it's for the victim's funeral. Maybe one of the people working at the church is a witness that he needs to interview, or maybe he just needs a quiet place to think. But I know, Pools, you were mentioning this in our group chat when we found this out, that it's of note that he's sitting there by himself and not with Robin or someone else.
Yeah, because that worries me. I wanted them to go on this road trip together.
Well, I'm sure they'll have other road trips together.
Well, they better.
I don't think any book now is complete without them going on some sort of travel. Yeah. Like the only one I could think where I don't think they did that was Cuckoo's Calling.
This doesn't worry me because it's not like he can't drive there and come back. He could just be going on an interview. I will say there's no reason Robin can't still be with him on this trip. It's just true. Joe didn't say she's sitting there. Maybe she's walking around while he's sitting. But this detail has kind of changed my whole perspective on what could be going on.
Mm.
I think in the past, she's used her headers for more case-related things, right? Which is why I thought they might be together interviewing someone. Although I don't know why, because that hasn't always been the case. Because
I know.
Both Lethal White and Ink Black Heart were locations that Robin went to alone.
And Strike went to Norfolk alone in Ink Black Heart too to visit Kia.
Yeah. So now I'm thinking that maybe Strike, he drives up there for the case. But maybe he's doing that thing we saw him do in Career of Evil where he goes around reminiscing.
Oh, like if it's the commune thing coming up again.
If it's near the commune. Yeah.
Okay. That could be a really interesting possibility. I could see
I would really like that because I could see him driving around. It could be interesting to see how his thoughts or his perspective is different after, what, 5 years? He might be more willing to think about these painful things this time, right?
Yeah, because, I mean, he has grown a lot in those 5 years, you know, and he's healed quite a bit.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say he's like a completely different person, but you look at the strike from C of E compared to now, and, you know, they are worlds apart. Massive progress has been made from back then.
He super has.
But yeah, like you were saying, Kenz, we've been talking about some of the reasons why he could be there. Can I throw out some ideas that I've seen people have?
Do it.
Like you said, a funeral. Some people threw out Rokeby, although I don't know why it would be a tiny church.
Yeah, Rokeby seems like the type to have like huge thing. Yeah.
He'd want Elton John performing.
He'd want Victoria and David there, like the Beckhams. He'd want all of the A-listers there.
Another theory was that it could be someone from his past, from the commune, since it might be around the same area. Possible. I don't really know if there's anybody that he'd want to see.
It's never been described that there's anyone from that part of his life ever. Yeah. So
I mean, the only person I can think of is Switch, but I don't know how that ties in.
Yeah.
I was thinking, like you said, Ken, said it could be a victim, a secondary victim, like Rochelle makes sense to me since they did go to her funeral because they kind of knew her of her before.
Yeah. If the first victim is a Jane Doe and they get the evidence, would they bury her before the case is solved?
Yeah.
So if the case drags on a bit, it could be the actual primary victim even.
Yeah.
He could still just be there to interview someone and sits down while he's waiting.
Yeah. That's sort of what I thought. Like, he's interviewing the vicar and he arrives during the sermon, so he has to sit down. Hopefully it doesn't knock over any flowers.
I don't know. I'd kind of like to read that again. That'd be great.
That would be so funny.
I kind of had it in my head that he'd be like following someone for a case, but I've been reading a lot of like spy novels and stuff, and there's a lot of that in it. So I appreciate that's probably pretty biased.
Right.
And also, like, from like a practical point of view, a stranger right at the back at a funeral, you're going to get attention being like, oh, well, like, who's that guy? Kind of thing. I wouldn't think that would be a sensible move. So that was my initial thought, but I appreciate there's a lot of holes in that one.
I actually like the surveilling someone and they go to church. So he's got to like be like, well, I'm going to church.
Yeah.
That makes sense. You know what?
You guys are making me see this differently again because for some reason in my head, I'm always imagining it empty.
Yeah, I was too.
Yeah.
Maybe it's full. Maybe there's people there.
We don't know.
What else did she say, Ken?
So as usual, because this not exactly new for Joe, she's pleading the fifth as far as whether or not Strike and Robin get together. Surprising no one.
Yeah. I mean, I love her. Okay. Because she puts a smirky face when she does it because she knows that we're dying. Hilarious. I kind of feel like she already told us, to be honest, when she said not to expect it immediately, but maybe I'm taking that too literally because I don't actually think she would give us the answer.
Yeah.
I would be willing to bet that she would say that even if this was the book where it happens.
Yeah.
It's not like she would be like, oh, yep, you guys are totally right. They're getting it on in this one.
Can't spoil it like that. Yeah.
I remember her talking about Harry Potter and the freedom that she felt after it was over to finally be able to talk to fans and answer fans, because she said it's so hard when they want to know things, but you know if you say too much that you're going to spoil so much for them and so much enjoyment.
Yeah.
So she, you know, I think she's careful about what she says, but it did feel like she kind of told us with that, but I don't know.
Told us that they are or that they aren't.
To me, it felt like she's saying that it's not going to happen immediately. No. To me, that said not the next book. That's how I take it.
Yeah, me too.
To me, I was like, well, yeah, of course. It's been 6 books. It's not immediately. So it's got to be the next book. was like my brain being like, yeah.
That's how I take her happy relationships don't make good books comment. Because people are like, how come it hasn't happened yet? So to me, I think she's saying, I wasn't going to have them get together in book 3 and then write 7 more books with them, you know, a happy couple. That's not what she's planning. That's how I take that. So I feel like that's possible as well. One day, if we get to talk to her, we're going to ask her about, what did you mean when you said all this and drove us all crazy?
She's like, I just did it to be a shit stirrer. I enjoy watching you all fall apart on Twitter. It's hilarious. To be fair, it probably is. But I'm like, yeah. So I don't know how to interpret this properly. But the funny thing is about pleading the fifth is people will automatically assume you're guilty if you do it. Because if you don't speak, they're like, oh, what are you hiding? So I think she is guilty of making them kiss in this book. Because I'm an eternal optimist and nothing can take that away from me.
Good for you.
Nothing.
I mean, I definitely didn't just Google pleading the fifth and showing my business there at all. No idea.
We don't have it. Yeah, we don't have it in Canada either. We just have a lot of American media.
Yeah, the Fifth Amendment, it's the right against self-incrimination, right? You have the right to remain silent.
Mm-hmm. Right. That makes sense now.
It really made me laugh when she told someone, be very careful, you might be hunted down by the Strike Robin shippers.
But I'm not going to hunt anyone down. People are allowed to be wrong. That's their right as Americans. It's free. It's a free
American.
You got to assume everyone's on the internet is an American. It's their right. It's a free country.
I'm sorry.
Do what you want.
Are you saying everyone who's wrong on the internet is American? Is that what you're saying?
That does sound like it's what I'm saying, isn't it?
I think that's what you're saying.
Uh-oh.
Shots fired there.
I'm pleading the fifth.
Okay. I feel like the people at this point that are like, I would prefer for them not to get together. Like, what books are you reading?
Yeah, it's been I don't understand it either.
Such a long time. Like, dude, just give it up. If you don't want them to get together, that's where this is going.
Go watch SVU if you don't want them to get together, you know. Oh,
Benson
shots fired.
And Stabler. Okay.
Ouch.
This is going to sound weird, but I don't really think of myself as a quote unquote shipper. I just think that I read them,
no,
you know,
because
I genuinely don't understand that perspective, because it is, I mean, it's so clearly set up. I don't get it, but you know, whatever you want to do, go for it.
The time to boohoo about men and women can't be friends was books ago.
Well, if that's the kind of book you want, then there's lots.
Go read something else. There's plenty of those. And we're not going to talk about the misogyny of certain people thinking that the romance plot is not deep or worthy of any kind of intelligent thought. Yeah.
Love is the most powerful force in the world. Did they not read Harry Potter and the importance of love? Come on.
I agree. I mean, I've definitely felt that occasionally.
Mm-hmm. Sort of condescension. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've even heard, you know, romances for bored housewives. So that's
deeply offensive.
You know, I agree, Ken.
I'm so glad that the man we have here doesn't obviously agree with that.
Sam's just sitting here silently, like,
whoa,
I mean,
you know, shippers are everywhere, and they may or may not be here. I'm just saying.
Embrace it. Embrace it. Yeah.
You got that label of a certain reader.
We are all certain readers.
I got my certain reader shirt on today, thanks to Rachel.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Beautiful. So great.
But let's move out of this controversial territory, kids. What else did she say?
Okay, so other important news, and this should delight us as fans of the epigraphs. She told us that all of the epigraphs from this book are going to be from the I Ching. So you were right.
So exciting.
Very exciting.
Somebody in the question when they were asking about where the epigraphs were coming from, the way that she phrased her answer was a little bit interesting. The person who asked it said, would it be a spoiler to ask what the link book / chapter intros / doodahs is? I often think I'd like to read that first in case it adds more texture to the chosen lines. And she says that the phrase chosen lines has a double meaning in reference to the original tweet. So,
well, I was thinking that it's the I Ching lines, right, that you read the lines.
Yeah.
The
I took it to be like, don't take it from the entire hexagram, take it from just what I've put here, that I'm whatever lines I've chosen to put as the epigraph, take that by itself.
Well, I don't like that. Just
I knew you weren't gonna like that.
God damn it, Ken. No, I'm not gonna allow that.
I think it's a reference to the actual I Ching and the broken lines and how you read it. That's what I thought it was.
That makes sense to me. I agree. I like that interpretation.
I am really, really happy about this, and not just because it's not Dylan Thomas and not just because this is what we've been predicting, but the more I learn about the I Ching, the more in my feelings I get about Strike and the opportunity for growth, because everything I read or listen to talks about using it to grow, using it to learn what you really want. I think we can predict some good and hopeful things from this. Oh, so I'm sticking with my prediction that this is the book of changes for the book of changes.
Fully agree.
Yeah.
Fully agree. Changes in every realm.
Yeah. And I guess I shouldn't automatically dismiss the idea of changes in Robin too, because that could happen and changes in their relationship as well.
Oh, that's
which
my
I...
number one change.
Yeah. That's what I'm really interested in too. I know the changes in Strike are going to be obviously
right, we already
awesome,
know of some of them.
Yeah,
it's super exciting.
Yeah, I feel like we know so much more about this book than we did with Ink Black Heart.
I feel like we do too.
I wonder if we're going to get any more little tidbits from her. She seemed excited to talk about it when she does.
She does. Yeah, I was putting together our Running Grave Predictions episode doc of just like all the things that we know so far. And I feel like the list is so much longer. It's like all we knew when we, you know, heard about the Ink Black Heart before the synopsis came out was just, it's a different demographic. Here's a setting. And that's like all we had to work off of.
Before we get started, I had one more thing. I was thinking about a theory I saw recently. It was someone on Discord, Eddie on Discord, was talking about how they thought that the Strike and Ellicott books could actually be structured as trilogies with parallels between the first, second, and third books of each set of three. And I really liked that because... Yeah, I know we talk about the theory that the books are set in a ring and that they parallel each other a lot, but this sort of trilogy grouping fits much more with how I've been grouping them together in my head. So you've got the first set of three books, Cuckoo's Calling, Silkworm, Career of Evil. That feels like the foundational trilogy, the first part of Strike and Robin's journey towards each other and towards becoming who they're meant to be. And it ends with a rupture. And then Lethal White, Troubled Blood, Ink Black Heart is the trilogy where the two of them are growing together as partners and friends, and they're each jettisoning their past hurts and their past anchors. So they're getting rid of Matthew and Charlotte. They're starting to heal from their traumas and address them. They're starting to open up. They're becoming firm, actual partners in the agency, with the glass door being the culmination. So this would mean that The Running Grave would be the first book in the next trilogy, where I think in this trilogy, they'll be full partners, and then their growth will be furthering their healing in regards to their past and coming together and growing in a new way.
What kind of way?
Well, I think you know which way. The start of their more personal, more romantic relationship is growing and flourishing in these three books now that their professional relationship is on such firm foundation. That's kind of what I was thinking. That's how I'm grouping these books together in my head.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
Yeah, I really like that, especially when you think of it from not like a story point of view, but like you said about how they are as people and how they're gradually, you know, growing close together and that whole relationship changing around each of those three. I completely get it. I think it's really, really good.
And I do see like little short three book arcs in their relationships and in their personal stories like this. And Eddie pointed out a bunch of parallels between the first and second and third books.
I'm going to have kind of a weird answer because I'm going to disagree with the theory, but agree with the conclusion.
Sure.
So I know what you mean about seeing them in your head that way, because I have too. But I don't know if I would say that it's intentionally being structured this way, because as we've discussed before, I feel like I'm kind of leaning more away from these kind of structural arguments. My guess is that if we asked her about it, she would say she doesn't do it on purpose, but maybe it's just the natural progression of things, particularly in regards to the books paralleling. So if I understand what you're saying, it's 1 and 4 parallel 2 and 5 and 3 and 6. But like we talked about last time, I see more connections with Ink Black Heart to Lethal White than I do with Career of Evil. I feel like it kind of just, when we find these parallels, it's the things that are important to us and not necessarily what she's doing on purpose.
Yeah, I think the connections between 1, 4, 2, 5, and 3, 6 were very much focused on the case. So like Career of Evil and Ink Black Heart both had a misogynistic murderer with a machete and multiple victims kind of thing, whereas Cuckoo's Calling, Lethal White both have a faked suicide.
Well, it's just that you always have these kind of things, and this is something I've talked with Anna Kiara about a lot, because she's never been a fan of, I hope she doesn't mind me saying this, she's never been a fan of like the ring structure theory. You know, her argument would be, well, you're looking for a book in six, but we had a book in 5, didn't we? So can we ignore the things that say no but only talk about the things that say yes? It just says what we're taking away, right? It doesn't necessarily, and anybody can find something different depending on how they're reading it. I guess I could see the arguments at the ending of Career of Evil and Ink Black Heart both end on a sort of relationship cliffhanger, but the way that I read the ending of Ink Black Heart fits more with how the Lethal White ending felt for me, where it's kind of the start of a new dynamic. There's a sort of hopefulness in what's to come for me. That's how both of those feel. But that's the parallels that I see. I think everyone sees different parallels. So to me, the paralleling, I think I'm backing away from a little bit. But like I said, I agree with the conclusion about 7, 8, and 9, but just for different reasons. So J.K. Rowling said that she plotted 7, 8, and 9. Well, now written 7, but You know, she's done that for the purpose of plotting the key moments in the relationship. So that tells me that, yes, that is happening, but not because of any structural argument.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see the running grave being the start of that romantic relationship, even if it's really small, mm-hmm. because now that they've admitted it to themselves, there's going to be a progression. And in my thoughts so far right now, mm-hmm. is that maybe it could be saying it out loud
to each other,
at least one of them to each other. It could end. Mm-hmm. I even think they might fight about it. That's something I've thought, but it's going to be a progression. Something is going to move. It's going to start, is what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Well, I'll certainly agree with that.
Yeah. I mean, every book has had them progressing forward in some way, despite the fact that some people think that last novel was a step back. It's just because they didn't say anything to each other. Their relationship still advanced forward. They both realized they were in love with each other.
Huge.
Yeah.
Huge.
It's just not in the way we wanted.
Can I read an email that we got just yesterday? Because I really liked this. And this is from Carol. It says, I started listening to episode 14 and wanted to get some thoughts down before I forget. I think all the wild speculation about Wombwell's tomb was not without merit. Edie states in an interview that the Inkblackheart is a metaphor. So if there's a metaphor for the logjam at the Stone Lion tomb, perhaps we can compare it to some father-child relationships. And I think that that's tying in the lion with Rokeby, right? They can be tricky and difficult to figure out. In the case of Strike, that relationship was painful. It perhaps holds him back more than he's been willing to admit. When he played Drek's game in chapter 68, it says, he just avoided being attacked by a digital vampire, then successfully steered Buffy Paws past a stone lion with the help of Robin's cheat sheet. Type, you as bad stony muffluck, bois, when a text arrived from his half-sister Prudence. It feels appropriate that he's successfully navigated around the lion with Robin's help, and that immediately following this, he got the text from Prudence, who is sure to reveal something about why and how she approached their father. There was undoubtedly more to it than telling him, you is bad, Sony Muffluck. But perhaps it was a start.
I love that.
I do too.
I feel like Strike might say some version of you is bad, Stony Muffluck to Rokeby.
Yeah, maybe rearrange some of those letters.
No, that is so I love that comparison of the logjam at Wombwell's tomb to Strike's relationship with Rokeby.
I do too. And great bit of insight. That's there,
so good. Thank you, Carol. I love that a lot. That is really interesting too.
Definitely gonna be keeping that in my mind as we go forward.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, should we do our Q&A?
How much of the novel is drawn from your own experience?
I've never created a book, and this book certainly isn't created from my own experience, you know, with a view to talking about my own life. That doesn't mean, of course, that your own life experience isn't in the book. You know, with this book, I'd been planning this book for so long, and then a couple of the things that happen in this book have since happened to me. And so I would like to be very clear that I haven't written this book as an answer to anything that happened to me. Although I have to say, when it did happen to me, those who had already read the book in manuscript form were, are you clairvoyant? No, I wasn't clairvoyant. It was just one of those weird twists. Sometimes life imitates art more than one would like. But no, it's not, this isn't about my experience of as being a creator. My experience, if I wrote about my experience as a creator, it would look very different. And I have to say, for example, which I think will be a question readers would ask, the Potter fandom, by and large, has been amazing to me, incredibly supportive, and I still receive tons of love from the Potter fandom. So the fandom in this book is very much not a portrait of the fandom. It's of a very, I think, a very different kind of fandom.
Well, first of all, it's nice to hear that most of the Potter fandom is still amazing to her, because I have to admit that that's not my perspective. Not everyone, obviously, but
no.
I think I've seen enough that I've been kind of backing away slowly.
Yeah.
But it's nice to hear that my perspective might just be a small portion.
I'm guessing she gets a lot of private messages, because one, the nastiness is so much louder. And two, if you are nice to her publicly, then you're going to get a whole backlog of shit flown at you as well.
And of course, I definitely believe her when she says it has nothing to do with the Potter fandom.
Mm-hmm.
Although I have to admit, there are some characters in this book that remind me of stuff. Just as far as that sense of ownership, dismissing the creator, you know. Mm-hmm. But that kind of brings me to my next point, that I think the thing to remember is that J.K. Rowling's experiences and what happened to Edie is not some novel out of this world idea, right? These things right. happen, especially to women. And it's not that she's clairvoyant, it's that she's observant.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That, Lindsay, was my exact thought. I 100% believe that Jo basically predicted what would happen in real life, not because she's psychic, not because she uses the tarot or the I Ching to read the future
right.
on Twitter, but because she is so insightful and perceptive. And like you say, she's observant. She sees the patterns behind human behavior. She clearly pays attention to what's happening in the world and, you know, online for this book. But to me, it absolutely makes sense that as a female creator, writing about a female creator, life would imitate art because Rowling's art is so true to life, if that makes sense.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Which, on a small side digression, that is my one criticism about the Hogwarts Legacy game. It's so much fun. It's so well built. You can tell that there's a lot of love that went into it. But there's not that heart of the story that you can only feel when it's something that's like written by her. You know?
She does have that particular something that just makes her writing hit you deeper. Yeah, it hits you deep.
Should we jump into the chapters finally?
Yes, we should. Yeah.
We probably should.
Okay. Chapter 45.
So in chapter 45, Robin interviews Tim Ashcroft, the pedophile, as Venetia Hall.
Sam, you should know that that's how we refer to him.
That's
his
fine.
Full name.
Yeah, that's his full name.
Tim Ashcroft, the pedophile. Yeah.
Just so we don't forget
officially.
No worries.
We don't want anyone to forget.
So the epigraph for chapter 45, to do good seemed so much his business that, having done it, she was fain to think must fill up his capacity for joy. And that is Aurora Leigh by Elizabeth Barrett Browning.
So in the poem, this bit is Marion Earle's reflections on Romney Leigh when they're engaged. He's a man obsessed with doing good and, you know, his charitable works. And I think that the context of this chapter, where I believe this epigraph is referring to Ashcroft the pedophile, I think that that gives this epigraph a sort of sly double meaning. Because whereas Marion seemed to reflect her own naive perception of Romney, here, Ashcroft's good work is merely a seeming. That is, it's all a front to hide his secret nastiness, right? Or even worse, it's a means of preying on victims. So in this way, his good work, it does fill up his capacity for joy, but it doesn't do that by the virtue of being good work. It's by enabling his actual horrible purpose. And Robin's perception of Ashcroft the pedophile in this chapter, she instantly perceives both that he is the pen of justice and that he's anxious of what Pez will say about him. So she sees through Tim, Ashcroft the pedophile, in a huge way. And I think that really contrasts with Marion's naivety in the original epigraph, because Robin is probing much deeper into Ashcroft's capacity for joy here. So that was my take on this. I really like the seeming kind of thing.
Yeah. I don't think I had anything really different to add. I was also reading this as Robin understanding that he only seems to do good, but knowing that something else is lurking. She isn't fooled by this cloak of goodness.
No, our girl is way too smart to be fooled by this idiot.
And this is also kind of a fun one because it tells us, at this point, I don't think we know much about him.
No.
But if you look at the epigraph, it's kind of telling us something else is going on here.
Yeah.
He's seeming to do good, but he's not.
Agreed.
So this chapter opens up with Robin contacting Tim Ashcroft, the pedophile, for an interview as Venetia Hall, and he just jumps at the opportunity.
I was going to say that Ashcroft, the pedophile, seems a bit publicity hungry, like he wants the exposure.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. That comes across big time.
It does. And my cynical side says that more publicity means more schools inviting him in, means more kids to prey on.
So something that's really impressive is because Tim Ashcroft the pedophile calls her back so quickly, Robin doesn't have a whole lot of time to come up with both a background for Venetia Hall as well as providing Strike with a cheat sheet on how to be Buffy Paws.
And yet she's amazing at all of those things.
Yep. Of course she is.
I love Strike's reaction to her cheat sheet because apparently it's thorough enough that his reaction is immediately, Christ, you reckon I'll need all that?
She wrote him a novel.
Yeah, exactly.
This makes me laugh because I think that Pools and Kenzie will both agree that this kind of feels like me with episode stuff.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, I'm the one who's over preparing type A about it. So I get you, Robin.
Yeah. I get it. You're very similar.
And Strike is such a organized person with that sort of stuff anyway. Like we've always heard about, you know, the amount of information he puts into like files and dossiers and stuff like that. So for him to be like Christ,
oh,
this
yeah.
has got to be pretty sizable, I would think.
Maybe he just didn't think an online game had that much shit in it. Maybe
yeah.
he didn't realize like yeah. what the hell she's been doing all day.
Yeah, maybe just thought, oh, you know, it's a walk in the park, it's a doddle. When actually, you know, you're just presented with this hardback sized thing on your desk.
And now he's going to have to go spend time in Drek's game and realize how much she's been suffering.
Yeah.
I love the note that she's upstairs again.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's probably safe to guess that Robin and Pat are the only two, not even just women, but people who are even yeah. allowed up there or who yeah. go up there.
It's mm-hmm. really sweet to me that Pat's now in that group.
Who can enter his fortress of solitude.
Yeah.
She's kind of taking on that motherly role to him that he's lost with Joan.
Yeah.
So Robin heads out quickly to go get ready for the interview, and it leaves Strike feeling bummed out.
Well, he asks her if she wants some tea, which I'm assuming is British for, do you want to hang out? Am I right, Sam?
Yeah. Yeah. It's very much a come over and have a chat for an hour.
Aww.
Yeah, it's that Aww. Sort of thing. But I love that he wanted that whole thing to be more than just a work chat and a brief encounter.
Oh,
I found
yeah.
that really
yeah.
cute.
So meanwhile, Robin's feeling a little resentful because she thinks that Strike has forgotten that she's moving soon. And to me,
yeah.
this feels like a little bit of a replay from Troubled Blood a little bit, where she's wanting Strike to show that he cares a little bit more.
It says that she was feeling resentful, and there's this really sarcastic bit where it says, perhaps he'd imagined she'd somehow achieved the feat without taking any time off work, but she'd still have appreciated a polite inquiry.
I love it when Robin gets sarcastic. I feel like what she really wants is for Strike to be thinking about her personally, not just as his partner.
Oh,
but
of course.
Yeah. She wants to be living in his brain, rent-free, just like how he clearly lives in hers. She wants that affirmation from him that he's thinking about her.
She wants to know that he cares.
Yeah.
We know that he does forget for a while because yeah. at Comic-Con he remembers and apologizes for forgetting, yeah. which instantly reminded me of Troubled Blood, just like you said, Kenz. But I like that, you know, it's kind of real to life because no matter how much growth either of them do, they're never going to be perfect. And
yeah.
Strike forgetting about Robin moving when he's injured and has so much on his mind is understandable. Just like her being annoyed by it is understandable. But seeing how he tries to fix it at Comic-Con
yes.
really shows that effort that he's really
yeah.
been making since their fight in Troubled
mm-hmm.
Blood.
And then
really
when
sweet.
He remembers again on the day and then shows up to
yeah.
help her, I feel like he made up for it.
Oh,
many
more
times
than,
over.
Yeah.
More than made up for the brief moment
yeah.
of forgetting.
Like you said, Sam, I think that they are both feeling like they're wanting more from each other in this moment, because he said he could have used a chat, but I think we know he means he could have used some time with Robin. He wants that connection too.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go back a little bit to my disappointment about Max that we talked about last time, because it explains that Robin's move had been postponed, and there's this line that says she had to witness Max and Richard's imperfectly concealed disappointment. And I wrote in my ebook how sad and disappointed I was to read that, because it makes me feel so bad for her.
Yeah.
But then I was kind of like, okay, I'm wondering if I'm being unfair to Max here. So let me flip this situation, right? So if Max was renting a room from Robin and Strike was going to move in when Max left, I'd be counting down the days, right? Get out already so they can do it in every room, including yours.
No. I get that Love Actually reference.
Thank
by
you.
The
I'm
way.
So glad. Thank you.
No,
I knew
I'm
I
here
could
for
count
you.
On you for that.
Yeah, you know what? I agree with you. Like Max and Richard, hey, they're love. You know, they
yeah.
want to have their little honeymoon moving in together.
A little love nest.
Like Robin and still be disappointed at the wrench being thrown in his personal life's plans.
Yeah.
But I feel bad for Robin having to.
Yeah, I do too.
But no, I do get it. I do get Max wanting to move his
yeah.
relationship with this guy up.
Right.
I hope it works out for them.
Now, I feel like I say this every time we see Robin go undercover, but the time and the care that Robin puts into her disguises is just like chef's kiss.
I love every one of them.
I would love to go shopping with Robin when she
yes!
asks for all of her disguise stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That would be so fun, right? To see how she's, this would change how I looked.
Well, I mean, I would go shopping with Robin and recommend her some things to wear.
Okay.
To get a certain someone to notice her even more.
Yeah.
I think we have an idea of what Strike is, you know,
what
his eyes are captured by. because we have privy to his thoughts.
Get her a nice wrapped dress.
I know what you mean.
Yeah, you know what I mean.
Okay, so Strike Text Robin, this game is fucking dull. And that just cracked me up.
I loved it. I think that Strike should be a video game reviewer, because I would totally read his reviews and buy his recommendations.
He would be like the Honest Trailer.
I love Honest
Trailers.
He'd be like, Octodad makes hopping on one leg seem easy. Not sure how Octopus fathered two human children. Implications are disturbing. 6 out of 10.
But anyway, this made us think of a listener question. Neither Strike or Robin enjoy playing Drex game. What video games do you think either of them have played or would enjoy, and why?
And we got a lot of responses to this one.
Yeah, people like their video games.
Or they have strong opinions of why they don't.
Yeah.
Quite a few people said Mario Kart, which is actually a really good answer, because J.K. Rowling has said that she likes to play Mario Kart. I think it was kind of a recent interview. She said that she plays as Yoshi.
That is fantastic. I absolutely agree with Mario Kart. I actually wrote Robin kicking her brother's ass at Mario Kart into a fanfic once. So I am obviously fully on board with this. I feel like Strike would get drawn into playing this. It's clearly an Ellicott family game at some future holiday. And I think he would really enjoy Robin beating absolutely everybody in the room, including him. I don't know what character Robin would play as. I play as Princess Peach.
I just imagine Strike as Bowser. But, well, yes. you guys can probably guess why.
Yeah, that one. I can guess
Don't
why.
Make me have a crush on Bowser, Sam.
You know what that reminds me of? That reminds me of that scene in Courier of Evil whenever Strike borrows Heartacre's mini and he's trying to like squeeze himself in there.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
We got an answer from Paula. She said they would both be excellent at mystery solving games like Sherlock Holmes or Hercule Poirot, but they would probably rather unwind with car racing for Robin and FIFA for Strike. A lot of people agreed with her because we got a lot of FIFA answers for Strike and a lot of car racing games for Robin.
Yeah.
Yeah, like Gran Turismo.
Those both seem likely to me.
One other game I was going to suggest, just because it does involve unsolved murder and stuff. Well, the case it's based off of is based off of an unsolved murder, but the game L.A. Noir.
I have that sitting on my shelf and I haven't played it yet.
But yeah, you have to like find evidence. You have to interrogate suspects and stuff. And you have to like watch their body language to see whether or not they're telling the truth or lying. Or if you don't have evidence to prove that they're lying, you have to doubt their story.
That'd be so much fun.
That particular game is based off of the Black Dahlia murder, which was famously never solved. Yeah. So,
I didn't know that. Pretty cool.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's a slight divergence from the actual murder, which was obviously never solved, but they solve it, quote unquote, in this one.
One answer that I really like and agree with is from Janina on Facebook. I could see both of them playing silly mobile games like Candy Crush just to pass the time while I just noticed that she wrote observating.
I did see that in the notes, so I was like, I'm just gonna leave that there. Observatory.
Oh yeah,
they're very observative, you know.
While observing suspects, I don't think they have the time or energy or the equipment to play serious games. So to me, in my opinion, this is the most likely. I think that they'd probably both have a couple of games on their phone for this exact reason, or even just to do something mindless to de-stress.
Yeah.
I totally agree that they don't have consoles at home, and if they play any games, it's just like this on their phone.
Yeah, as a Candy Crusher myself. Yeah, I agree. They, you know, they have crossword game apps too. Strike might like those. Oh, yeah. I feel like he's really good at crosswords.
Yeah, you can't tell me that Strike doesn't play Candy Crush on the toilet too. Like, come on.
Reckon they Wordle?
Oh, maybe. Yep. Yeah, I agree about crosswords too, because he knows random facts. He'd be great at trivia or crosswords.
Yeah, he'd be great at Wordle. He'd be great at Redactyl too, which I love.
Rebecca on Twitter, or JennyW1981, said she could see them playing Words with Friends against each other, which I love. Yes, I can totally see that.
I feel like Strike would be infuriatingly good at that game.
Yeah.
He would drive Robin insane.
Yeah, that's why I don't play my husband.
Yeah.
And Robin would be determined to beat him. They could be really cute with that, the little comments that they'd send to each other. But that was a fun one.
I liked it.
Yeah. So before Robin has her interview with Tim Ashcroft, the pedophile, she thinks that the venues chosen by interviewees were often an early guide to character. Are there any instances in the series where the interview location doesn't indicate something significant about the person's character, or do you feel like it usually almost always points to something?
I think it's almost easier to answer that the other way around. Like, which one do you think really says something about the person? Mm-hmm. Because my first thought was immediately of Chisel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So no offense to the real life Pratts, although actually maybe it should be. But you know, because the men only up to more recent years, the stuffiness. I don't like that they kind of strip people of their identities by making them call themselves George and Georgina. I don't know if that's a real
that was
thing.
A bit creepy.
I would imagine that's a real thing, right?
Yeah, I think it mm-hmm. is.
So I think that said a lot about Chisel and how little he thinks of other people who he sees as beneath him.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. Another person that popped in my head was Fancourt, although I don't have a really well thought out answer. It's just the club was a lot of bright and bold colors that kind mm-hmm. of maybe reflect his loud personality, although personally I liked the color. But the fact that Strike has to sit on that little poof thing maybe shows how Fancourt makes other people uncomfortable with his personality, I guess.
Yeah, I thought of all of the silkworm people and their bloody lunches, all of them.
Yeah, these book people.
And Strike even wonders what Robin would think about the venue that Waldegrave picks. He's like, would Robin be amused by this? But yeah, I think it does. I'm going to pay attention to that going forward.
So what do we think the description of this place says about Tim Ashcroft the pedophile? So it says that it was a dimly lit and, in Robin's opinion, self-consciously sophisticated space. Hmm. To me, the dimly lit says he's hiding something.
Oh, mm-hmm. yeah. To me, yeah, Ashcroft certainly does not want a light shining on mm-hmm. certain activities of his. And he's definitely determined to present a certain image. He's very conscious of how he's coming across. That's his whole thing, because that image is at odds and cloaking his real self. Yeah.
He says that he chose it because it was less likely to be interrupted by any of his parents' friends. Do we believe that? That sounded weird to me.
I didn't really go much on that at all. Like, I don't think I've ever purposely avoided anywhere because I might bump into anyone.
Yeah, yeah, really.
Like, let alone like my parents' friends. Like, that seems a bit weird.
It does, doesn't it?
And I know he said it was a self-consciously sophisticated space, but it didn't come across to me as like particularly flash. I thought he chose it because it would make him appear more normal.
Just ugh, everything about Ashcroft is ugh.
Yeah, speaking of ugh, hearing Tim Ashcroft, the pedophile, talking about how much he likes working with kids, and especially like these disadvantaged kids that he's talking about, is so gross.
It's really emphasized here. And of course, some people do really like working with kids, but
the fact that he's a pedophile.
Yeah, and knowing what we know, it's definitely a clue as to who he is, as is the epigraph.
Yeah.
So during this interview with Tim Ashcroft, the pedophile, at some point, Tim Ashcroft, the pedophile, rattles off Iago's soliloquy from Othello. Do you guys have any thoughts about the significance of why he chose that particular soliloquy from the play?
I was going to say, before you clarified it was Othello, I was going to be like, now this is not Iago the parrot from Aladdin.
Nope. Gilbert Gottfried is not involved in this in any way.
It's a different Iago.
Well, I got some help with this. So I asked Kurt about this on Twitter because he's a Shakespeare professor. And if you don't follow him, you should. Here's what he said about the soliloquy itself. He says, Tim chooses a soliloquy by the villain of the play, Iago, who is here bragging about how he is using another character simply for his money. Iago thinks he's very clever and smart, certainly smarter than the fool Rodrigo, whom he is exploiting. Thus, he says in the second through fourth lines that he wouldn't waste his time hanging out with such an idiot if he didn't plan to profit from him. This speech is also the moment at the end of Act One when Iago hatches his plot to destroy Othello by making him believe that his wife Desdemona is cheating on him. Here too, Iago brags that he can outsmart other people by appearing to be friendly and disinterested. So that was great and definitely helps, because I think that we can easily apply that to Tim Ashcroft the pedophile.
Absolutely. Robin is really playing on Ashcroft's hunger for publicity, for more opportunities. But Ashcroft thinks that he's the one using her. He's like, oh, she has a connection. I'm going to be using her to get publicity and jobs out of this interview. But no, she flipped it. He's the one being taken in here.
Yeah, but he also does think that he is so much smarter than everyone else. Like all his victims, he thinks that he's smarter on Twitter, which is crazy because he's so bad at it.
Such an idiot. He thinks he's Iago. He's no Iago. He doesn't have the brains to back that up.
No, he has an actual parrot brain, is what you're saying.
He's more like Iago the parrot.
Like Iago from Aladdin, but that's kind of insulting to Iago from Aladdin. So I wouldn't want to insult that parrot. He was not that bad.
Iago in Aladdin does redeem himself.
He does.
The sequels. He's a good guy.
There's no redemption arc for Ashcroft, the pedophile.
Speaking of other icky moments,
we got a lot of them.
We did. Yeah. We sure did. Yeah. So another kind of icky moment here is when you're talking about whether or not he has children. He says that he needs to find someone happy to have kids with me first. Huh. Says Tim Ashcroft, literal pedophile.
It's so weird to me the way he says this, that he says, I need to find someone happy. I mean, normally people say, I got to find someone first.
Yeah.
It's that's a what weird I thought. Way to say it.
Yeah. You'd be like, oh, well, you know, need to find someone to have, you know, he's
like
a
his
laugh,
end result
just like...
is just kids, not the actual being with somebody else.
For me, it also reflects Zoe and how unhappy she is.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know, like, I need to find someone happy first. So not the person that, you know, I don't know. It's just a weird way to say it.
The phrasing is really weird to me, and I don't know why he says it this way.
On a less icky note, there is so much about this interview that I enjoy, and it really, to me, starts to highlight how much Robin has started to come into her own as far as becoming a really good detective that's on equal footing with Strike. And some of the things that I really enjoy here are Robin's disguise and her accent, her backstory for Venetia that she's able to use to her advantage because she's kind of able to suss out what exactly is going to make Ashcroft start talking. Mm-hmm. And then her careful manipulation and the flattery that she's able to use in order to kind of coax that information out of Ashcroft the pedophile is just amazing.
Yeah, the way she's speaking, you can tell that it's different just by reading it. It's not even an emphasis on an accent change. It's the language and the fake enthusiasm that she uses. Which, by the way, I think Holiday Granger, she absolutely nails that when she does Venetia Hall. It's so good.
So does. Yes.
So good at that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I totally agree. The stuff that she came up with for her fake husband is incredible manipulation. She manipulates him so well in this
she
whole
plays
chapter.
Him like a fiddle.
Yeah, she lures him in. She keeps him wanting something from her. It's absolute genius.
Mm-hmm.
There's the whole flow of that conversation, but it's also, when you notice it, the silences and stuff that she leaves in between and gets him to fill them and naturally just gets him to not dig himself a deeper hole, but to kind of like leave that conversation and kind of get to those places naturally. That was really well done.
She's in total control here.
Mm.
It's really, really good.
What I found was really interesting. There was this little moment where he was talking about basing a character on one of the kids who used to hang around at North Grove. He said that he had really bad acne, this kid, and he always looked like he was trying to make himself as small as possible. And my character, Lionel, he's pure evil, really, but in the play you go back and see him bullied and denigrated. And, you know, Ashcroft does this sort of taking on this mannerism, which I guess he's a good actor. But it made me wonder if this kid he based his character on could have been Gus. If this was Gus from a few years ago when Katya was taking him to the art collective, because the bad acne could be his hives, his problem with his face. Mm-hmm. And we know he seems like the kind of kid who would have been doing that don't look at me kind of thing.
That one line that you just said, he's pure evil, really. But if you go back and look, you see him bullied. And of course, that fits Gus 100%. He's evil, but look at what kind of abuse he's also suffered because of his father. Yeah, I like that.
Mm-hmm.
Should we go to the part where he talks about the Inkblack Heart being problematic?
Oh, hang on. I got to secure my eyes so that they don't roll out of my head first.
Oh, okay. I remember saying before that I couldn't understand why he didn't just bring these things up with Edie if he felt so strongly. But I guess he did, because it says that they had a fight about it specifically over Drek. So he was arguing that Drek was anti-Semitic and Edie was saying that, no, it's inspired by the plague mask.
I feel like Ashcroft jumping to Jewish character over these tiny details, like living in a big mausoleum, manipulating people, and having the plague doctor silhouette for your face, which is a really recognizable thing that is not connected to Jewish people at all. Everyone knows what the plague doctor looks like. I just feel like jumping to that immediately says a lot about his own unconscious prejudices and anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe he could stand to examine some of his unconscious biases, if you know what I mean.
You know, the thing that kills me is when he says that his point is proven by Wally's video. How?
Right? Like, how? What is the logic there?
I don't understand it.
How does that prove his point at all?
It proves absolutely nothing.
It makes no sense.
The sad thing is that people use this kind of logic.
Yeah,
in real life.
Yeah.
It's just mind-blowing. The only thing that could have made this interview better, I think, is if we got to hear Robin's actual thoughts about the things that he's saying. So, you know, out loud, she says, this is exactly the kind of discussion we should be having on reality show if it's made. It could be so powerful. And I just really want to hear her real thought, like, you idiot, you know?
Yeah.
I'm noticing the same kind of thing that I did with the Philip Orman interview, where he doesn't actually have bad takes about other people. And at this point, we don't know that he's Tim Ashcroft the pedophile yet, but he doesn't like Wally, which I agree with.
Yeah.
And he said that Edie's relationship with Philip Orman wasn't healthy, which again is correct. And even his suspicion over the Havening and his observations about them backing Wally, they're not wrong.
I mean, I feel like you would have to be a pretty terrible person and an idiot to not have these takes. Like, any sensible person could look at Wally and the alt-right trolls in the stream and be like, oh, that guy and his Holocaust jokes, he's not great. He does recognize these things. Good for him.
Well, I think my point about us not knowing yet is the fact that we agree with all of these things.
Yeah.
So
that's true.
It's keeping him, it's still kind of a mystery about who he is and where he lands on things.
That's true.
Because he's not wrong about people. Mm-hmm. But I find his opinions to be ridiculous.
Yes.
So he says, I'm obviously not saying it was her fault, or because obviously what happened was bloody terrible, but art should be moral, right?
Oh my God. That quote in particular is sent me to an insane place when I read it, and it does every reread. So this view of art as like a guide for moral instruction, as didactic in nature, is so incredibly narrow and depressing to me, because art should be a lot of things. Art should be interesting. It should be provocative. It should engage with the world. It should hold up a mirror to it. It should say something about a topic. You can have moral lessons in art, like look at Harry Potter. Art is one of the most powerful ways in which we explore moral questions and like gain empathy. But to put moral purity and instruction as art's most essential purpose is to suck all of the nuance and all of the fascination and all of the power out of art. If your only concern is creating depictions that align with the prevailing cultural morality, then your art's going to be shit. It's not going to push boundaries. It's not asking questions. It's literally just coloring by numbers, making sure that you stay in the lines. It's not art.
Well, it's also not reflective of real life.
Yeah, it's not reflective of real life. It's reflective of this idealized image at the tip of a purity spiral, and if you deviate from it. But nothing in life does live up to it.
You know, that reminds me of, it's been like a couple of different books now where they've taken books that were written like a while ago. I think it was like Dr. Seuss and somebody else.
It was Roald Dahl.
Yeah, where they went back and took stuff that like could be construed as offensive and tried to make it more sensitive instead.
I think they did it to Agatha Christie too.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm pretty sure that they did it to Agatha Christie too.
But you can't go back and memory hole and rewrite works of art. That's not how it works. It reminds me of listening to the Witch Trials podcast. You heard back when Harry Potter was, you know, going through its first Christian backlash. Heyday? Yeah. You hear Christians boycotting the Potter books, saying things like, the book shows someone drinking unicorn blood to stay alive. That's dark magic. It's corrupting our kids. And I'm like, that's the bad guy doing that. The book is depicting like this dark and twisted thing to hit us in the gut with how evil this guy is. But to you, just showing it at all is morally dangerous because you have no sense of the context. And Ashcroft is a champ at ignoring the context of the depictions in Inkblackheart, as we see later on his Twitter. It's just that the two reactions feel very similar to me.
Well, I think that's why it was included in The Witch Trials.
Yeah.
I feel like I need to have an obligatory comment saying we're not all like that. But just, you know, obviously. But I think my favorite part of that episode was hearing the end. And how, I can't remember his name, but the one man, how he had changed his mind and said...
He actually read it.
Yeah, you have to actually read it to know what you're saying. If you talk to her, tell her thank you for these. And I was just like, oh, that made me like teary-eyed almost to hear that. Because I experienced a bit of that growing up, for sure. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get into Harry Potter until I was a little bit older, but that was definitely part of my experience.
Mm-hmm.
Not my take on it, but others' takes on it.
Yeah.
But anyway, there's this part where he bursts out talking about what it's been like in the wake of Edie's murder. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It's hard to say how you would react to something like that because you never know. But I don't think that I would ever resent having to be interviewed or give an alibi if my friend was murdered. Do you know? No. Like, he just wants to move on because he doesn't want anyone investigating around Northgrove and around him.
Mm-hmm.
I just hate the implication of we should just move on and not investigate this. But of course, that's how he would feel.
Yeah, because he's not actually a good guy.
Yeah, it also seems like he's trying to lay the groundwork so that Robin doesn't believe anything she might hear if she talks to other people.
That whole interaction with him and the way he comes across is just so insincere and just self-indulgent. Mm-hmm. And like you said, trying to make it all about him. It's a deflection thing. Of course it is, but it doesn't paint him in a good light.
No. One thing I was curious about here, when he talks about having to be interviewed by the police, he says, of course, he had an alibi. He says he was with someone all that day and that they confirmed it. So was this what he was and Zoe were talking about in the cemetery over the phone when she said he was happy enough for her to say she was with him when it suits him? That was her giving him an alibi. But where was Ashcroft really if he wasn't actually with Zoe, his alibi? Do we ever find that out?
Probably with a younger girl.
Oh, God.
That's what I would think.
Oh, that's awful. And I hate it. Yeah, because he's not going to get arrested for being with Zoe now, as long as she doesn't reveal how long it's been going on. Oh, I hate the idea that he was with a younger girl.
I don't know what else it could be.
I was hoping he was just alone and had no alibi, but no.
I guess it could be that, but I don't think so.
Ugh.
So he thinks that Annamie is Rachel.
Yeah, he does. He thinks that because when he kept trying to hit on Rachel on Twitter, she eventually told him that she was Annamie in a DM to scare him off. Yeah. And he believed her because he's not actually that smart of a guy.
That would be scary for him if she was Annamie and he was hitting on her.
Oh, yeah, if enemy. Yeah.
She could say a lot.
Yeah, I can see why he was a bit freaked out by that.
So to round off this chapter, Tim Ashcroft, the pedophile's attempts to cover up that he knows who Pez is are just so pathetically awful.
They really are, aren't they?
What is his name? I don't know.
Oh, gosh, what is it? Oh.
I guess he really isn't that great of an actor if he can't.
Yeah, could he be more suspicious?
I don't know, Chandler, but you're right. It's pretty pathetic.
I love how Robin sniffs onto that right away. She's like, hello.
Yeah. And also, like, getting right on your phone immediately, as soon as she gets in the car, it's like, really?
That's a little sus.
Are we ready for 46?
Chapter 46,
All right. In chapter 46, Strike does research on the Brotherhood of Ultima Thule members on Twitter.
So this epigraph reads, I dreamed and saw a modern hell, more dread than Dante's pageant, not with gloom and glare, but all new forms of madness and despair, filled it with complex tortures, some earth-bred. From thine own earth and from its happiest lot, thy lust for pain may draw full nourishment. And that is Constance Naden's The Pessimist's Vision.
So I think this is Strike diving into the incel world as he sees with the Lapine's Disciple account, aka Gus, aka Annamie, and also the neo-Nazi world with the Al Gizzard accounts or Oliver Peach and Vile Pechora. Because I would definitely describe those two things as modern hells, right?
Yeah.
But there's also, this is just Strike's reaction to Twitter in general. Like, he's seeing the worst. He's seeing the worst possible sides. I mean, for the record, I love it, but he's seeing the worst possible sides.
Yeah, my interpretation of this is basically Twitter is a modern hell, and there's no better torture and misery than the shit that people dream up for each other and themselves. Although I too am on Twitter.
Makes me very happy.
Yeah, there are many things about Twitter that make me happy as well. But yeah, I agree. That's basically my interpretation of the poem and the chapter. Strike diving into all of this is an expose of the worst kind of hate and nastiness that proliferates on the internet. And it doesn't just stay on the internet either. The rhetorical violence erupts into like actual material violence. He talks about Lapine's victims or Gus. Yeah. Gus starts killing people in real life. It's hard sometimes not to have a pessimist vision when you're scrolling through the worst bits of Twitter. But yeah.
So the chapter opens up with Robin calling Strike to tell him about the interview. And this is where I love Strike telling her that he's gained a new appreciation for how tedious playing the game must have been for her.
Yes, she needs extra pay, boredom pay.
Yeah. It's a nice bit of acknowledgement for the work she's been doing.
Her way she said, all part of the job. Did she say that with a bit of a, all part of the job kind of thing? Or
that's sweet, though.
Yeah.
Because they have both acknowledged before that the boring bits are part of the job. The surveillance gets boring sometimes. Standing outside in the cold gets boring.
I'm immediately thinking about them having to sit outside of Eleanor Dean's house.
Yes.
You know how boring that must have been.
Yes. But they both know it's part of the job and they both love the job anyways, and they're still going to do it, right? Yeah. So it's kind of sweet to me.
So after Robin and Strike get off the phone with each other, Strike and Jack are texting a little bit, and
so just cute.
Bless Jack, right? He's so, so sweet. This exchange that he and Strike have made me crack up, where he goes, how is your leg? Is it better? And he's like, hasn't grown back yet, but everything crossed.
I love those, love those sorts of jokes.
I wonder if Jack brags to his friends about who his uncle is.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I would.
I am so glad that one of the things we know about the Running Grave is that Strike is successful in his diet and quitting smoking, right? Because this whole paragraph about needing to do all of these things or risk permanently damaging his leg.
Yeah.
But it says, as he had no immediate desire to take any of these sensible measures, he was choosing Strike to channel his self-recrimination into rage at Thurzaz. I was like, dude.
It's such a male thing, isn't it? That's a future Sam problem. Sad. Yeah. It'll get better on its own. It'll be okay.
Yeah.
I like that we get to see explicitly this attitude here, because it contrasts with the growth later. The moment where he stops blaming other people or circumstances and starts actually wanting to make these changes. It's a big moment for him. It's a big moment for anyone who commits to this kind of growth or to changing their life. And having this be groaning at him makes me even prouder of him later.
Yeah.
But yeah, at this moment, I'm like, God damn it, Strike.
Yeah. And also him being forced to be home and go through all this online stuff is really beneficial to them. It really pays off. It's just a huge win. Makes me a little bit even more salty at everyone for being so rude in the previous chapter. Because look at how much he accomplished.
He accomplishes a lot.
He should have thrown this in their faces a little bit more, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Look what I did, you jerks.
I love his deep dive into Twitter here, because it's such a good representation of the fact that if you put something on the internet, that's going to be there forever. And you can be tracked down by it. I also like, it's just, he's such a good detective, even online on this platform that is not native to him.
But yeah, so he is going through Twitter here. There are so many comments that he sees. I mean, we get Oliver Peach and Gus in there a lot as Al Gizzard and Lapine's disciple. We see the Pen of Justice being annoying again. So much racism happening.
Yes.
I gotta say, speaking of the unpleasantness that's going on here on Twitter, this whole back and forth between Annamie and Edie after the Drek recast is so infuriating. And I just have to say that Joe really nails that portrayal of toxic online communities so well.
It's just like them casting a black Hermione in Curse of Child.
Mm-hmm.
Or remember when they cast an actual black child to play Rue, who was black in the novel but people can't read and don't want to picture,
or Kim being a black actress being cast in Troubled Blood. That did it as well.
People get real mad. I have a feeling that there's going to be casting in the new Harry Potter series that people are going to be pissed off about.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Good for them.
Anyway, let's get back on track.
We've mentioned this before, but I really love reading about Zoe and Rachel being supportive of Edie, because they're one of the few people in this book that aren't just total shits.
Yeah,
and you know what else about that is that they're brave enough to do so in that kind of toxic, especially for two teenage girls. That takes a lot of guts.
It does.
It really does.
So another thing, while Strike is stuck up in his flat, not able to go anywhere, Pat shows up and she gives Strike some printouts, and his reaction to her bringing him fruitcake is just priceless. He's like, did you say cake? You made it?
That was really sweet.
And then her insistence that the cake wasn't just for him, you know, both made me laugh and touches my heart a bit. I love Pat and Strike's budding friendship so much. It's my favorite.
Yeah, it's the best, wasn't it?
Yeah. Am I the only one who wants to believe that she absolutely made it for him and then is throwing out this whole team morale thing as an excuse?
Yeah.
Because I don't think fruitcake is going to stop the grumbling, but it sure is going to make Cromerin feel better. So, yeah.
Does she know that that's his favorite? Does she know that?
I don't know.
Because, you know, that also says a lot. Does she know?
I reckon she knows. I mean, they share an office, don't they? Like,
yeah.
Interactions with those two are going to be great in Running Grave. I know we said it before, but I'm really looking forward to that.
It's worth saying that again. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I kind of also wish, though, that she hadn't said the thing about team morale, because now he knows that people are complaining and upset with him. It just makes me feel even worse for him that the thing he's worried about that people are thinking is kind of now confirmed.
If it was anyone else in that situation, would you rather find out in like 2 weeks' time when you come back and everyone's in a really shit mood, or would you rather know now and kind of mentally gear yourself up for it? I think I'd rather know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's good that she brings him the truth in that way.
Yeah.
I mean, I was just kind of hoping they'd all shut up about it by the time he got back and be like, look at all this amazing work he did while he was up there.
Yeah.
In their faces kind of thing.
I also like that Pat made sure to say that Robin could handle it, because I like that Pat believes in Robin. Robin's got it. Robin has it under control, because Robin's a badass and Pat knows it. Mm-hmm. Yes,
Robin's
I know.
Also part of it.
Grumbling. Well,
she's also part of the grumbling, though.
She's only grumbling in her head.
Strike ate the fruitcake, which was very good, feeling a mixture of renewed guilt, irritation at whoever it was who was bloody bitching, and a totally unexpected new appreciation for Pat, who, during his incapacitation, had provided a brand of matter-of-fact assistance he found strangely soothing. I really like the "who is bloody bitching." That was very funny.
I would always think like complaining and bitching as being two very different things. Complaining is actually having something to complain about, whereas bitching is just doing it for the sake. That's what I would associate with that.
Mm-hmm. I also like to imagine that at some point he texts Pat and asks if there's more cake. So I like how it says that he gets sidetracked by some unrelated arguments on Twitter, but he's actually not, because the two people who are interesting him are Oliver Peach as Al Gizzard and Gus as Lapine's disciple.
Yeah, Lapine's disciple. As a Canadian, this massacre is still a big deal for us, even though, I mean, it happened in 89. But there's a day of remembrance for the victims and for action on violence against women because of it. I've heard my mom talk about this shooting. It took place a couple of years after I was born, and she lived in Quebec. She was the same age as a lot of the women who died. And it's such a significant and horrible event in our national history. And to see a Twitter asshole with this name, there's a lot in this book that's sickening, but this one really hits me personally, I think. But I love that Strike is honing in on Lapine's disciple and Al Gizzard, even though he thinks it's a sidetrack, because that's his instincts. He senses this. He's following his hunches and he doesn't even know it at this point.
Because he's not Nutley.
I thought this part was a bit of a clue that Lapine's disciple was also Anami, because it says that he harassed Kia Niven on the basis that she used Anami to amplify her claims of plagiarism until Anami had seen through her. So unless this person is some massive Anami fan, it seems weird that this account would harass her for something that she did to Anami.
We also get him suggesting that someone bug their stepmother.
Yeah. And there's a little bit more here that reminds me of Rick and Morty, actually. It might be another sign that this fandom is based on that fandom, because it says that Lapine's disciple went after the franchises that he thought were being ruined by female actors and writers, which, from what we talked about, is a thing that happened in that fandom.
Yes, I could totally see Lapine's disciple being a Rick and Morty asshole as well.
The things that Gus is saying as Lapine's disciple are just disgusting. Like, reading through this was just, I was making a face the whole time.
The thing that I like in here is how much it concerns Strike.
Yes.
And it says that there was nothing he could do since there was no location or name for this person. And I think that might imply he might have tried to do something.
I'm sure he would have. This is another instance of Strike's instincts being spot on. He sees someone here who is on the path of escalation, who's going to erupt into actual violence. He recognizes that. He knows it. If he had thought he could have found and alerted the authorities to this, I think he would have.
With Twitter and stuff, it's not like you can look up who owns the web address or whatever. You know, it's just complete anonymity around it all as well. You've just got that username and anything else they go off of.
You kind of can. You might have to have a PI license, or they might not have licenses there. But there is this thing that I used when I worked for a PI, and it was new then. So if you can find out someone's email address, which you can generally do from a background report, if you can find out an email address, you can search all of their social media, and it will give you this gigantic report of everything they've ever posted online with any of the email addresses that are associated with their name. It's kind of scary. But that would have been very helpful for this case.
Yeah, really would have been.
I thought about it the whole time I was reading this book. You know, if they just used...
Although I can't imagine that Anami doesn't use throwaway emails for all his different accounts, right? He's got to have throwaways for everything.
That's interesting.
But yeah, it's kind of scary. If someone did that on me, they'd be like, what is happening over here? So then Strike switches to the Algazard account, which is Oliver Peach.
And one little aside here, Strike being petty about the Algazard account being a Chelsea fan is so funny. It's so petty, but it's so funny. It's like, I already don't like you, but you're a Chelsea fan too. Like, oh no, absolutely not.
I'm finding Strike's love of Arsenal more and more endearing lately. It could literally be any team. I don't know the difference, but his dedication is cute.
I really
love that bit in Silkworm where he felt like if he had been paying more attention, they wouldn't have lost. It was so funny. This account, they have some words that they use for women, and I love that it says that Strike had to look some of these up.
Yes.
That's very endearing to me.
It makes me like him so much more that he does not know these ridiculous slurs on the internet. Deeply endearing.
We come towards the end of the chapter, and this bit where Strike finally figures out who Thurzaz is such a deeply satisfying part of the mystery for me.
Yeah,
it really is. Gotcha. And it says that he calls Murphy, and it makes me laugh now, because I wonder if Murphy's thinking like, dang, I wish I would have been able to find that, you know?
Yeah.
I wonder if they love it or they hate it when they see his name pop up on their phones being like,
God damn it. What the fuck is happening now?
Yeah.
It's either going to be something else has happened or he's found something and one-upped me.
Yeah. It's got to be a bittersweet kind of, oh shit, it's Strike again. I hope that Murphy is a good enough cop that he's like, oh, it's a hot tip, thank you.
Oh, I'm sure, but at the same time, it's got to be frustrating. Gotta that be it's a not you.
Yeah, yeah, a little bit.
He's gonna be thinking, I just can't measure up to Strike in different ways.
Oh, so many different ways.
So chapter 47, we see the moderators on Drek's game talk about their plans for Comic-Con.
The epigraph, these blotched souls are eager to infect and blow their bad breath in a sister's face as if they got some ease by it. And that's Aurora Leigh by Elizabeth Barrett Browning.
I think that blotched souls here, it's talking about a sort of a moral infection, a moral taint. In the poem, it's referring to a fallen woman who's perceived to be eager to drag others down to her level, to sort of bring them into her sin so that she's not alone in it. But in this section, Valpatrora and Lord Drek are manipulating two different women to draw them in and use them for their own horrible purposes. Of course, the irony is that one of these women is even more of a blotched soul who's breathing right back at them. Anami, as Paperwhite, is the one sort of infecting Drek and Petrar with his manipulation, leading them to their downfall.
I was just thinking that this is about Lord Drek and Valpatrora as they're kind of weaving their disgusting way through all of these chats, like a poison that's infecting everyone. And they enjoy the chaos. That's what the epigraph says. They got some ease by it. They enjoy it. But I think you're right that it's also being done back at them and they don't see it coming.
Yep. I don't feel too bad for them, I'm not going to lie.
I'm excited, though, because it feels like we haven't had a chat chapter in a few episodes.
I know. Yeah. I had to go dig up my hard copy to read this. But I think that this one is really fun on a reread when you know. This one is especially good with Paperwhite. And mostly because it's Paperwhite manipulating someone else horrible, so you don't have to feel awful and upset about Morehouse. This time I get to be like, idiots.
So in the middle of this discussion at the beginning here with the mods, is it bad that the first thing that I thought upon rereading Vile Petura's question about whether or not people have their masks ready, I momentarily forgot that masks exist as disguises and was thinking about COVID masks for a second.
Yeah, that checks out.
Well, yeah. The upper graph really primed you for it, right? Like breathing bad breath and I could see that.
Yeah,
that would be unusually thoughtful for him.
I'm just thinking that masks would be pretty beneficial for Strike and Robin when they're doing surveillance, right? Once they get past the initial COVID
lockdowns, the masks will definitely be handy for them.
And they could use it for a long time.
I know. Be like, it's our new normal.
And you know that Robin's going to have a bunch of different kinds of colored ones.
Well, yeah, you got to have different color masks in case somebody sees you can swap it out real quick. So
smart.
Hey, that's a
genius.
Good one.
But anyway. Going to Hartella, though, you know, sometimes she makes finding the sympathy for her difficult for me, because this is one of those times where she's saying how it would be so unfair for the police to come in the game because no fan would do that to Josh. And I was like,
jeez,
that makes me so angry, because the implication that murdering Edie is fine, fans would do that, but not to Josh. Like,
Oh my god.
And I'm betting that she's never watched or read a single bit of crime or true or fictional if she thinks that there's no reason to investigate a whole group of really good suspects. She's a little delusional in her thinking there.
Her nastiness about Edie in this chat generally is pretty gross to me.
And then this bit where she tells Worm that Edie was in it for the money, I was like, you mean her job?
Right? Like, no shit. God forbid that an artist wants to get paid for their work. Like, how awful that a young woman who suffered extreme poverty and homelessness has a chance to support herself and takes it? Oh my god, how dare she?
You want an income?
Oh my god.
Exposure bucks don't pay the bills? What?
The audacity of her.
Yeah, that got me.
Fixing.
And good for Zoe, though, for fighting back.
I love Zoe in this chapter. I'm tired of everyone shitting on her. She was a good person. I know she was. So fuck you, Hartella. And then storms off. Listen, that was a power moment for her.
Yeah, big time.
Okay, I think that was really good for her. Show some of that spine that she showed on Twitter.
Yeah.
So Lord Drek enters the moderator channel. I don't know if it's just me, but it was really disgusting to me how much of a kiss ass Hartella was with Lord Drek here.
It's really weird that she's saying all of this out in the open, because it's really obvious that she's hinting hard at something.
Yeah.
I get the impression that she wants to impress others with this relationship she thinks she has, or the secret she thinks she has, you know, that she would welcome questions, because why be so obvious about it? Makes me think of, I don't know if it's Strike or Robin, I can't remember, who later thinks that they don't think that she's had a lot of romantic success. It seems like she really wants to emphasize what she thinks is happening here, which is kind of sad, but also embarrassing.
I agree fully. The secondhand embarrassment, the cringe I get from reading this, it's powerful.
Yeah, I get secondhand embarrassment too.
It's really bad.
But I am trying to remember the words that came out of my own mouth and be more mad at Lord Drek, because my sympathy for her does come back when I read the things between Lord Drek and Vile Petura. I'm so disgusted by both of them. In this chapter,
they are really disgusting.
You know, the things that they say, it honestly turned my stomach when they talk about her. They talk about her weight. I imagine the humiliation she's going to feel when she goes to see this actor at the stage door. It's just horrifying. It makes me feel really bad.
Yeah. You know, I might loathe Hartella too, but she doesn't deserve this kind of treatment. I'll side with her against these two assholes.
Let's switch to the private conversation between Paperwhite and Vile Petura.
Yeah.
In the group chat, Vile Petura mentioned wanting to meet Paperwhite and knowing what she looked like. And I'm certain from later in the chat that he was trying to lure Paperwhite into this private chat to get information from her.
I'm sure he was. But why wouldn't he just open a private chat with her and ask? Maybe he wants to be tricky?
Well, no, he needed her to be angry at Anime for showing him the picture. He wanted her to be angry enough to give away who he was, is what they were trying to do.
Okay, that makes sense.
But the funny thing is that Paperwhite or Gus, pretending to want to know, how Vial Pachora saw her picture was just fake.
Yeah.
And Gus trying to lure Vial Pachora in so that he can make sure that he goes to Comic-Con. They're both trying to trick each other, and it's just, oh, it's my funny. God.
Yeah.
You're kind of made for each other here.
Yeah.
I like this private chat between Lord Drek and Vial Pachora. It's satisfying to read because they're talking about how Thurzaz was taken in for questioning.
Yes.
And they said, there must have been a camera in that gents. It feels like we're seeing the results of all that work that Strike did on Twitter, and it's kind of fun to think about all the behind-the-scenes stuff that must have happened to get to this point now after Strike called Murphy.
Yeah, and Murphy clearly took his tip very seriously and acted on it right away.
And they got him.
I do love seeing all of Strike's Twitter sleuthing coming to fruition here. Seeing the effect on the criminal side is always fun.
It's really good, and to see it almost like instantaneous between chapter just now and this one, you know, seeing them talk about it and, like, you know, the repercussions of it, I really liked as well.
Yeah, I just do wish that I would have seen, like, everybody else's reaction to it and, like, wow, great job, you know. I'm gonna be salty about it for a while. He deserved another good boy for this one.
I'm sure Murphy told him good boy.
No, but Murphy wasn't the one being hard on him. I want you know.
Yeah.
Then Lord Drek agrees to let Vial Pachora go to Comic-Con, which I think was a very poor decision on Lord Drek's part.
Terrible.
Not just because of what happened to Vial Pachora, but why would you trust him to do literally anything?
Honest to God.
Yeah.
And I like how he says, for fuck's sake, don't do anything dumb. You know that Oliver's going to do something dumb. The guy's an idiot, right?
I guess, to be fair, we don't actually know what he did.
Well, he didn't stand far enough back from the gap. Is what he did. He stood too close.
It just makes me think Anime must have been following him around
the
whole time, waiting for an opportunity. That was a really not well thought out plan on Anime's part, and he just saw it and ran for it.
It was pretty reckless.
It's very reckless.
How could he have guaranteed that he got out of that subway station, right?
Or how could he even guarantee he'd have an opportunity to actually kill him?
Like, what if he had stood kinda back?
You know,
did he have his machete hidden? Like, what was he gonna do?
I don't know. But just lastly, in this chat between these two, this is where we do get confirmation that they are not on to Strike, that they do think it was the police. So what Murphy said is confirmed. I was very relieved by that.
Yeah. Well, briefly relieved. Briefly relieved does not last for long.
No.
But at least for the moment, we can say, oh, good, they're not getting a parcel bomb in the office.
For now,
the fruitcake is safe.
All right. Sorry it took us so long, Sam, but we got to
No, don't apologize. It's all good. Don't worry about it.
Thanks for coming on. We're so happy to have you back.
It's always so fun.
Yeah, we have plans for you to come back again, right?
Yes, definitely.
Marked your territory, but that doesn't
sound like that took a leap. Yeah. But no, it's really cool. I really love doing it with you guys, and it's great to see you all again. So it's really cool. It's great to be back, and just thanks for having me. I really enjoy it.
All right, Kenz, what are we doing next time?
So next time we're doing chapters 48 through 50 of part 3. And in those chapters, we see Strike interview Kaya Niven, and then Robin chats with Paperwhite as Buffy paws while watching Gus.
Oof. That's when Strike gets attacked by that bird.
It is.
Poor Strike. Yeah.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.